The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, my name is Naomi Lambert from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will share articles with you from The Assembly, which publishes in-depth reporting on North Carolina at theassemblync.com. So today we're starting with a very topical issue, and that is sports, more specifically ice hockey. The Canes were in a death spiral, and now they're hot. This article was written by Luke DeCock. Every seat was full at Lenovo Center again on May 5th to see the Carolina Hurricanes in the second game of the second round of the NHL playoffs. Every beer skate, a plastic mug fillable with beer, soda, or candy, sold out in their debut that night, all 4,687 of them at $31 a pop. The team's latest promotion to go instantly viral. The Hurricanes beat the Philadelphia Flyers in overtime, their sixth straight win of the postseason. Sports bro whisperer Pat McAfee even spoke reverently of the Hurricanes on his show the next day. Priceless publicity for a franchise that spent most of its existence being mocked for that very existence. In every aspect of the game of professional sports, financially, virally, and most importantly, competitively, the Hurricanes seemingly can't lose. There's not a team left in the postseason that's ever beaten them in the playoffs. All their frequent nemeses have been wiped from the slate. They've won all eight playoff games this year and are eight wins from the second Stanley Cup. After 29 years in North Carolina, they've become a model Sun Belt franchise in a city that wasn't exactly screaming out for a Major League Hockey team, run now by a hands-on owner and a general manager with a chemistry PhD. These are good days to be a hockey fan in the Triangle. The thing is, that was also true 15 years ago. The Hurricanes were in this position once before and threw it all away. The team's recent success and rebirth came at the end of a decade-long playoff drought that cast the franchise's future in Raleigh into considerable doubt, squandering much of the hard work the team did to put down roots in the market. That breakthrough Stanley Cup championship in 2006 became a campfire tale older fans would tell to bore the kids, less relevant with each passing year of bad hockey and empty seats. The Hurricanes probably shouldn't still exist in their current form. They survived perhaps because Gary Bettman, the NHL commissioner who steered original owner Peter Karmanos to move the team here in the first place, refused to back down from the bet he placed on the Triangle. He was right about that. The fan base the team built during an improbable, miraculous playoff run in 2002 that survived a lockout that wiped out an entire season that grew exponentially during the 2006 championship run, it never died. It was just dormant. New owner Tom Dundon, who committed to putting a competitive team on the ice when he took over in 2018, breathed new life into it. The kids who watched the Hurricanes win the Stanley Cup in 2006 have families and disposable income of their own now. They've never known anything else. From laughingstock to the cup. It all started when what is now the Lenovo Center was just a hole in the ground next to Wade Avenue, and Karmanos needed a new home for his Hartford Whalers. A self-made software magnate, Ponytail Pete, had his interest piqued by Raleigh's quixotic bid for an NHL expansion team in 1996. But the team would have to play in Greensboro while the arena, originally intended for NC State basketball before a pivot to accommodate hockey, was completed. The 2 years in the Triad were a disaster. The team's new mascot, Stormy the Ice Hog, nearly suffocated inside a Zamboni while making his debut. A triumphant reveal turned macabre. Without a dedicated fan base willing to make the drive in traffic, the Hurricanes played to crowds of a few thousands, if not hundreds, most nights. They were a laughingstock. There was buzz around the shiny new building in the fall of 1999, but by the time Halloween rolled around the next year, interest in the team had all but bottomed out. Officially, the announced crowd of 7,016 that Tuesday night remains the lowest in the team's Raleigh history outside of the COVID season of 2021. Unofficially, it was fair to wonder how the team was going to survive. At that time, I was thinking, this is crazy. How is this ever going to work? Said Chuck Caton, the Hall of Fame radio broadcaster who moved with the team from Hartford. It's almost impossible now, given the excitement that surrounds the team every April, to convey the apathy towards the Hurricanes as they opened the playoffs in 2002. But with each successive win, the Hurricanes' flags multiplied on cars in the triangle. As the Hurricanes reached the Stanley Cup Finals before falling to the powerful Detroit Red Wings, what had been a sideshow in a market obsessed with college basketball became a unifying force, a single rope that fans of NC State and North Carolina and Duke could all pull together. Transplants ditched their old hockey allegiances. Natives embraced a new sport. Those memories were still fresh in the spring of 2006, even after 2 years out of the playoffs and an entire season lost to a lockout as players and owners fought over a salary cap. The Hurricanes made it all the way to Game 7 of the finals against the Edmonton Oilers at home with the Stanley Cup in the building, unboxed and polished. The crowd stood and screamed for the entire 60 minutes and long after as Captain Rod Brind'Amour ripped the cup out of Bettman's hand to hold it aloft before the commissioner was even done with his speech. They went on to another run in 2009, making the conference finals, and those three playoff runs established the Hurricanes in the hockey world. If nothing else, they introduced ACC-level tailgating to hockey at the same time the sport introduced itself to the triangle. In the back of your mind, there's always this question about whether the market will warm up to the sport, since it's not native to the area and it has to compete against ACC basketball and football and all of the rest, said Harvey Schmidt, who played a key role in bringing the team to Raleigh as the longtime CEO of the Greater Raleigh Chamber of Commerce. In the early years, even though we may have been sort of muddling through, we weren't necessarily breaking through the noise to be a compelling case. After 02 and certainly after 06, you're going, this is going to make it here. All of that was on full display in January 2011 when the Hurricanes successfully hosted the NHL All-Star Game. It was a moment to take stock. The Hurricanes had never seemed more entrenched, nor their foundation more solid. Then they choked at home in the final game of that season with a postseason berth on the line. The drought would last a decade, and everything that seemed certain in 2011 was again in doubt by 2018. It was very discouraging. Few people in the triangle paid attention when Thomas Thews died in 2008. Thews was a co-founder of CompuWare, the company that made Komonos his money, and he'd gone along with Komonos on his hockey adventures as a silent partner. But CompuWare made software for mainframe computers, not exactly a growth industry in the 21st century. Komonos was already stretched thin financially, and the Thews estate wasn't interested in a minority interest in an NHL team, let alone funding ongoing operating losses. Komonos sold a small chunk of the team to 10 local investors in 2011 to raise funds, but without ceding any control. By 2016, he had been sued by his adult sons who alleged he raided their trust funds to pay the bills. The ongoing capital crunch had extraordinary competitive impacts on the Hurricanes. They went from the middle of the pack in payroll to the bottom, by 2016 spending the minimum to remain in compliance. Losing season followed losing season. Jim Rutherford, the team's general manager for its entire time in North Carolina, retired in 2014, only to pop up 2 months later with the Pittsburgh Penguins and a budget at the top of the salary cap to win two more Stanley Cups. His replacement, Ron Francis, a Whalers star and Hurricanes' first big free agent signing in 1998, struggled under the same constraints, as well as his own bizarre inability to make a single player-for-player trade. Instead, he picked up other teams' leftovers and dumped salaries for draft picks. It was very discouraging to me, Caton said. There were many nights where I was starting to lose my enthusiasm for doing these games. It wasn't because I was in my 60s, because I always wanted to do it. It was just getting to be a chore, as far as realizing they weren't really going anywhere with the way they were doing things. These were dark years. Brind'Amour was stripped of the captaincy in the middle of the 2010 season. Cam Ward and Eric Staal, two heroes of 2006, became franchise scapegoats, lambasted by disgruntled fans for failing to lift an underpowered team back into the playoffs. Rutherford's attempt to jumpstart the franchise in 2012 by trading for Staal's brother, Jordan, didn't work. The two never made the playoffs in four seasons together. Francis traded for a few useful players and had some acute picks in the later rounds of the draft, current star Sebastian Aho among them, but his first-round selections, key to the success of any rebuilding, were largely wasted. Meanwhile, attendance plummeted. As late as 2013, the Hurricanes were still averaging more than 17,000 fans per game, but by 2017, they were last in the NHL at 11,776. The team was non-competitive and, worse, irrelevant. To his credit, Karmanos always believed in the market, but his financial constraints bled into every aspect of the franchise. The Centennial Authority, which oversees the arena, was exploring much-needed renovations in 2014, but had to put them on hold because of the ownership uncertainty. Looking back on it, it feels now different than I ever focused on or reflected on back then. But the phrase that pops into my head is monotonous mediocrity, said Brent Baringer, a Carey lawyer who spent 25 years on the Centennial Authority. Just slowly sliding downhill. Certainly not an upward or positive trajectory after all of the amazing excitement and performance of 2002 through 2009. Inexorably negative year after year. Declining attendance led to declining revenue. Declining interest led to declining corporate support. The Hurricanes were trapped in a death spiral. Dundon calls the shots. Dundon cut a controversial figure from the start, eschewing suits and ties for athleisure and basketball caps. The Dallas billionaire made his fortune in subprime auto finance, played pickup basketball with former Dallas Mavericks owner Mark Cuban, was a primary investor in high-tech Topgolf, and had been looking for a major league team to buy and run his way. The deal closed in January 2018 as Dundon shot hoops on NC State's court while waiting for the wire to clear. Karmanos would remain a minority owner, but Dundon would call the shots. Within a few months, he'd fired both Francis and coach Bill Peters while empowering Eric Tulski, the hockey analytics guru he inherited from Francis, who is now the general manager. The Hurricanes had never worn the old Whalers gear, beloved by hockey fans. Dundon put that in motion. Over the next few years, Dundon cut costs behind the scenes. He let Caton and TV play-by-play man John Forsland go, while hockey insiders criticized his refusal to play the going rate for coaches and GMs, a debate repeating itself in the NBA now after Dundon bought the Portland Trail Blazers. But on the ice, the Hurricanes' payroll, 30th out of 31 NHL teams when Dundon bought the franchise, shot up to first by 2020. No team has been more active pursuing blockbuster deals, but his biggest move was naming Brind'Amour coach and letting him establish the team's identity the same way he had as captain of the Stanley Cup champions, giving him unusual input for a coach in personnel decisions. The Hurricanes ended the playoff drought in Brind'Amour's first year and never looked back. They're one of only three teams in history to win at least one playoff round in eight straight seasons. All I know is, since he's taken over, we went and paid the players, Brind'Amour said last month. He said, what do you need? And I said, we can't be $25 million below what everyone else is paying. That's not going to work. Now there's all those other things behind the scenes. Everyone's talking about cutting this, that and whatever. That's his business. That's just bottom line stuff. I can only speak to what I know. And I know he wants to win. Emboldened by the success, fans came flooding back. Merchandise, Hurricanes and Whalers alike, flew off the shelves. The Hurricanes played a historic outdoor game at Carter Finley Stadium in 2023 that would have seemed impossible only a few years earlier, when those games were played almost exclusively in traditional hockey markets. Corporate sponsors bought in, including Morrisville-based Lenovo, which took over the naming rights for the home arena from PNC Bank in 2024. Dundon originally bought 61% of the team, with the franchise valued at $505 million, buying out Carmanos to take sole ownership in 2021. In March, he sold a 12.5% minority interest at a valuation of $2.7 billion. It's a testament to how hockey can put down roots and captivate a market, Bettman said before the game at Carter Finley. It's a testament to Pete Carmanos' vision and Tom Dundon's execution of elevating everything this franchise does on and off the ice. And it's a testament to a generation of hockey fans. Meanwhile, the long-delayed renovations of the Lenovo Center are finally underway, inside and out. Dundon is developing the 80 acres of surface parking around the arena into a $1 billion infill urban center with shops, restaurants, housing, offices and hotels, something Carmanos had the right to do but never the inclination nor the capital. Then Raleigh Mayor Marianne Baldwin called it the biggest economic development in the history of the city. As part of that agreement, the city and county allocated $300 million in tourism tax funds to upgrade the 25-year-old arena. Fans can now watch games from a new bar overlooking the ice in the upper level, while the well-heeled can spend intermissions in luxury new suites under the stands. That work will continue over the next two summers and conclude by adding a sleek new facade that echoes the team's new look on the ice, a physical manifestation of a new era in the Triangle. Final article, Outside the Box by Michael Ventulo Mantovani. A pizza box shield, a small rectangular Amazon package with two ice slits cut into it, makes a perfect helmet. Boxes that once protected a toilet tank and a flat-screen television now protect a teenager's torso. And dozens of pieces of small handmade weaponry, swords and knives, staffs and bludgeoning tools, all of it made from discarded cardboard and ready for combat. At the event organizer's command, two teams sprint across the small green at Carborough Town Commons, crashing into each other near the center. "No headshots," the organizer shouts, reminding the overeager warriors of one of the cardinal rules of the day. Cardboard broadswords swing through the air, landing with a thud on thick cardboard body armor. Small claws of cardboard and painter's tape rip and pull at their opponents' fastenings. The cardboard wars might not be an only-in-Carborough sort of thing, but it's definitely something you'd expect to find in the artsy little town next to Chapel Hill. The cardboard wars are the brainchild of Jessica Love, a freshman at Chapel Hill High School, inspired by an event in Australia called Box Wars. The cardboard wars is a form of live-action role-playing, or LARPing, an immersive storytelling-based game in which participants typically dress up as fantasy characters, medieval warriors, knights, elves, mages, and rogues. "I like to build things and then fight with them," Love explained. Redonia versus Bluington. The April battle was the second iteration of the event. The first, held last December, drew some 30 combatants and several dozen spectators. Love relied on her friends and schoolmates to help spread the word. She also reached out to local news outlets like radio station WCHL and community blog Triangle Blog Blog, which is where I learned of the event. The spring rematch was a bit more sparsely attended, but with about a dozen warriors ranging from ages 5 through their late teens and early 20s. Despite the dip in numbers, the fight was no less exciting, according to some of the more seasoned cardboard warriors. Love's cardboard wars were a bit less focused on storytelling than a typical LARP event. We spectators knew little more than Red Team versus Blue Team, or the Nation of Redonea versus the Republic of Bluington, though a few of the Kabul warriors had a well-honed backstory. "I am the Pillar," said one of the blue team's warriors, a local high school student who didn't want to give his real name. "I am the leader of the Carcinization Nation," he continued, referring to the evolutionary process in which non-crab crustaceans develop crab-like bodies. "I am a couple of million years old." An experienced cardboard warrior, the Pillar explained how his armor, weaponry, massive claw-like arms to bludgeon his opponents, a trio of axes stored on his back, and even a crotch protector to, well, you know, an accoutrement including a crab taped to his underside, took the better part of a week to create using cardboard, hot glue, paint, and tape. The Pillar was joined by the Carapace, a subordinate in the Carcinization Nation, and the warrior with the most intricately crafted suit of armor. "I was summoned by my leader," the Carapace, who also appeared to be a high school age, said, motioning to the Pillar with claw-like hands. "And through the ritual, I joined the Carcinization Nation." "What exactly does the ritual entail?" I asked. "Summoning," the Carapace said, refusing to elaborate further lest I summon my own warriors to stand against the Carcinization Nation. The wild rumpus starts. While it was clear that a few warriors spent hours building their detailed weaponry and armor, some of which looked more like manga-style mech suits than anything medieval or fantastical, others showed up in minimal gear with little weaponry or even completely empty-handed and unprotected. Preempting this and wanting to be inclusive of anyone looking to join the fracas, Love came to the rescue with heaping piles of extra cardboard, scissors, straight razors, and three different kinds of tape. To wit, my 8-year-old son, who came along on this reporting trip, was resolute that he had no interest in entering the fray. Then he saw not only the creativity on display, but how much fun everyone seemed to be having as they prepared for the battles. In no time, he began quietly fashioning a small broadsword out of the pile of extra cardboard and asking me to help size up his body armor. As the warriors put the finishing touches on their armor and weapons, a parent pointed out that the sides were wildly uneven. There were 7 blue fighters against only 2 red warriors. It seemed that most of the little kids were drawn to the Carcinization Nation, thanks to the outsized style of the Pillar and the Carapace. As a few stragglers rolled in, Love assigned them to the nation of Redonea, evening things out as best she could. Everyone ready, all weapons checked and approved by Love, she directed each side to opposite sides of the small field at the centre of the Carbra Town Commons. Behind each, she placed a flag, 1 red, 1 blue. The battle was on, capture the flag style. Teams needed to seize the opposing flag and return it safely to their base to be crowned victors. Love's rules of engagement for cardboard wars were simple. Have your weapons checked before the fight, no headshots, and once your armor is destroyed or torn from your body, you're out. Other than that, it's a melee with little direction from Love, and the warriors are hemmed in only by the boundaries of the grassy field. Rule number 3 seemed to allow the warriors to have the most fun. Cardboard is incredibly sturdy, and destroying it to the point where it fell from anyone's body took time and repeated blows, stabs, swipes, and even rips. It wasn't until the 3rd battle of the day, an all-versus-1 boss battle in which Love told everyone to attack the Pillar, that most of the armor began to fall away from the fighters' bodies. After 2 games of capture the flag and the boss battle, each lasting about 10 to 15 minutes, the cardboard wars ended. The yellowing grass at the centre of Carbra Town Commons was strewn with detritus. Scraps of cardboard, bits of tape, tips of swords, handles and hilts. A few tears needed drying, especially amongst the younger set. A few scrapes and bruises needed tending. As the warriors cleaned up their battlefield, picking up the remnants of the fight and piling them beneath a shady tree, Love reminded everyone to come out for the next cardboard wars, which she'll host in November. The fighters quickly reverted to being just a group of kids. A few reenacted their favourite moves from the battle, while others headed off for ice cream. For several of the warriors, ultra-creative and imaginative kids who spent the better part of the previous 2 hours beating the shit out of each other under a hot springtime sun, it seemed that the cardboard wars were both a means to commune over a shared love of fantasy and a way to flex their artistic muscles. Why waste a beautiful day playing Dungeons and Dragons or fantasy video games at home when you can get outside and fight the demons, in this case, an army of crab-like humanoids? Yourself? Michael Venutolo Mantovani is a writer and musician living in Chapel Hill with his wife and their children. He has contributed to the New York Times, National Geographic, GQ, Wired, the BBC, and several others. I'm going to finish with just the top of an article about K&W cafeterias, The End of the Line, by Nikki Miller Carr. At K&W cafeteria, you didn't order so much as continue a pattern. You knew what you were getting before you ever picked up the tray. The line moved at its own pace, slow enough to consider, fast enough to keep things moving. Fried chicken or baked? Green beans or butter beans? Macaroni and cheese that held its shape? A square of cornbread? Maybe a slice of pie? The clientele also had its patterns. Retirees who came in at the same time every afternoon. Church groups dressed from Sunday service. Families who didn't want to wrestle with a menu. That pattern held for decades. Until, slowly, it didn't. I grew up eating at K&W like so many people across the south of my generation and the two before mine. The line, the tray, the routine. It was familiar long before I understood how it worked. Years later, I saw it from the inside, working as a private chef for the Allreds, the chain's founding family in 2013 and 2014. Founded in Winston-Salem in 1937, K&W cafeterias later expanded into South Carolina, Virginia, and West Virginia. At its peak, it had 35 locations. Theirs was a model that, for a time, met people exactly where they were. All the way up until the last location closed its doors on December 1st, 2025. There was a kind of golden age to it, when dining out didn't need to be an experience, it needed to be reliable. People wanted familiar food that would fill them up, served in a place that felt recognizable, clean, well-lit, consistent. The choices didn't change much, and that was the point. The dining rooms carried a quiet sense of occasion without ever asking too much of you. The heavy drapes, elegant sconces, and thick patterned carpet suggested formality, even if the ritual itself was simple. Well, unfortunately, we have to leave it there. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Assembly. We hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to tune in next time for more topical articles about your state. I'm Naomi Lambert for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This broadcast is now available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time, and if you have any questions or comments, please call me on 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.